2011. Standing there in that office in Georgia with a former president and his first lady, I was overwhelmed with joy. I remember first getting my job and having someone tell me never to get jaded, and this was one of those moments when that popped into my head. It's easy to get used to the "what am I doing here" moments. It's easy to get into a mindset that you have always lived that lifestyle and forget that 10 years earlier you were waiting for 7 hours in the standby line at Tower Records on Sunset so you could meet George Michael, and never did because once he got through the line of people who had wristbands, he couldn't get to the standby line because of time constraints. And it stung even more because you were second in the standby line and you could peer into the store and see everyone having a nice moment with him. Anyway, getting to experience some of the things I've experienced will never get old, and I'll never get used to it. I think of this moment every time I see Jimmy Carter in the news, building a house with his bare hands or beating cancer in his 90s, and remember how welcoming he was to me, even though he didn't need to be. It reminds me that you can often be blown away by how kind some people can be, even though they've experienced the highest points of notoriety. I've been lucky to meet and work with people like that. And although fame can get old, human greatness never does. Bill Clinton. In 2016, Conan moderated a panel with Bill and Chelsea Clinton for the Clinton Foundation. Even watching from backstage was a big deal for me. I was thrilled to have been even a small part of planning this event. It was their annual Clinton Global Initiative University, where college students from all over the country came for a weekend of networking and workshops. It was a fantastic event, and this was the closer for the weekend. Conan did this great Q&A with President Clinton and Chelsea, and afterward, we all found ourselves outside the auditorium where the Q&A had taken place. When I looked behind us, I noticed a line of people who were clearly getting ready to meet the former president. I was standing there with Conan, the head of our digital department, Steve Beslow, and one of our bookers, Britt Kahn. We stood there as Clinton made his way to us and started talking to Conan. Steve, Britt, and I kept moving out of the way so the two of them could have their privacy. And the former president kept moving with us to include us in the conversation. It was an awkward circular dance with multiple people involved, like a very slow human tornado. Clinton's time in office was problematic, and ultimately the scandal that got him impeached was disappointing to those who supported him. But he was still a president for 2 terms, and again, my joy at being in a position where I could meet someone that influential wasn't lost on me. Also, President Clinton was in office while I was alive. I remembered his presidency, and that made him a larger-than-life character for me. He wasn't a person, but a caricature, a saxophone-playing, lower-lip-biting Southern charmer. That moment in that hallway after the onstage Q&A, he became a human being to me. I have no idea what he said, though. My thought process went something like this. Oh my God, he was the president. I wonder what it's like to live in the White House. If I lived in the White House, I'd have parties every week. I wonder if you can invite anyone you want to come hang out with you when you live there. What is he talking about? Why did he just say irrigation? Should I be paying attention to him? What if he asks me a question? Oh no, he'll realize I'm an absolute idiot and I'll have to make something up and hope it fits into the conversation. I wonder what Arkansas is like. Is there an actual Little Rock in Little Rock? Where did it get its name from? Is he the most famous person from there? I mean, who else would be more famous than a former president? It's like Nixon being from Whittier, I guess. I can't believe a president is from a town that is so close to where I grew up. Why am I thinking about Nixon when Bill Clinton is right in front of me? I wonder if Hillary is ever going to run for president again. I'm sure she'll do great. And so on. Before I knew it, we were in a circle gabbing with the former president for what must have been at least 25 minutes. The long line of people he had to meet behind us was getting visibly anxious. Eventually, someone from Clinton's camp came in and broke up the conversation so he could move on to everyone else. I really wish I had paid attention to what he'd had to say. Gender. I chose a profession that has a very problematic history with sexual boundaries. I came into it fully naive, and eventually, when I encountered a woman who I thought was unfit to work in a certain position, I assumed she had slept her way to the top. I was unabashed about it, completely unapologetic about my assumptions about certain women. I was a part of the problem until the Me Too movement blew up and I had a reckoning that the way some women are treated in the entertainment industry is more than gross. It's abusive and criminal. I'm shocked that until then, I had chalked up the way some men spoke to me as part of me paying my dues. I needed to be harassed to move up. How dumb. Here are some stories about the times I came to a harsh realization about my role as a woman in the entertainment industry and how it shaped my image of authority. A lesson in gender roles. I made it a point to have an internship every semester in college. When I first started school, I wasn't sure if I wanted to work in movies or TV. After interning at a film production company, I learned that the movie industry moves too slow for me, and I preferred the almost instant gratification that television gives. In the movie world, there's pre-production that takes forever, then shooting that takes forever, then post-production that takes forever, and then what you're left with are these 2 hours of film. I'm sure I left out a ton of steps, but I don't work in movies, so who cares? On the other hand, you could shoot a TV episode in 1 week and it could be on the air the next. Or, in the case of late night TV, the day of. What a thrill. Anyway, that's not relevant at all to this topic. What is relevant is that in one of my earlier film production internships, I got a harsh lesson in gender roles in the entertainment industry. I was 19 and had gotten an internship at an independent film production company in Los Angeles. It was a small company, so they gave the interns a good amount of responsibility. At one point, one of the assistants in the company gave me a script written by the daughter of one of the producers of Rocky. He said to read it and give him notes, which I did. I wasn't crazy about it, and neither was he, so he told me to call the person who wrote it and tell her we were passing on the script. I didn't understand why I would be the one making that call. It felt like too big of a job for an intern, even considering the extra responsibility. At the time, I didn't know that passing on a script meant we're not moving forward, so I called her and told her we were passing the script on, which has a completely different meaning. "You're passing the script on?" she asked. "Yes." "Oh my God, so one of the producers is going to read it?" Me, completely befuddled and confused. "Yes." "This is so great!" You could practically hear the champagne bottle popping in the background. Me, sweating. "Okay, so someone will call you. I've got to go." I knew there had to have been a mistake. The assistant and I had talked about the issues with the script, so why would he want me to call this woman and tell her we were passing the script on? Also, who were we passing the script on to? Why didn't I ask that question when he told me to make the call? And finally, why was I making that call? I was a 19-year-old who had been working in the entertainment business for 5 minutes. I wasn't even paid. I didn't know why the assistant had me calling this person and telling her if we would be moving on with her project. How was that my job? Couldn't I just make a coffee run? I went back to the assistant and I told him what had happened with the call. He looked visibly frustrated. Fuck this guy. Again, why was I making that call? To make matters worse, he made me call her back and explain the misunderstanding. What complete hell I was living in that day. I called the woman back and gave her the bad news, that I had misunderstood their assessment of the script and that I misspoke. I never told her I was an intern who didn't understand the business, which was the sole reason I was doing an internship in the first place. Seriously, no one wanted coffee? I might as well have been negotiating contracts. She was understandably upset, and we hung up, and I wanted to climb into a hole. Okay, so I'm realizing this story has little relevance to this topic, but I'm already rolling, so bear with me. A couple months go by, and at that point, I'm in comfortably with everyone in the company. It's small, and I've been given a fair amount of responsibility, clearly. So I'm feeling good about myself. One of the producers in the company asks me if I can help him sort scripts in his office, an opportunity I jump on. I'm eager to ask anyone who is willing to listen a million questions. And I think, what better time to pick someone's brain than when we're sorting scripts? Before I can even ask if it's okay for me to ask him questions, he says, "Now would be a good time for you to ask me whatever you want to ask." Giddily. "How did you get started producing movies?" Generic. "Easy." He answers. "Is this what you always wanted to do? Again, generic. Easy. I'm throwing softballs here. It's how the entire conversation goes. Who's his mentor? What did he study in college? Uninspired questions getting canned responses. Until my last question, which is when I ask him if he has any advice for me. Women in this industry only move up if they work 10 times harder than men or if they're insanely attractive. Well, shit. Even though I was hungry at that age, I was aware of who I was. I was never going to work 10 times harder than anyone. I was going to put in an adequate amount of effort and then cross my fingers that my charisma would propel me the rest of the way forward. Even if I were the type of person who might be able to pull that off, I don't even know how you would quantify working 10 times harder than a man. Do you take how many hours he is working and multiply his hours by 10 and work that many hours in a week? What if he works 40 hours? There are way less than 400 hours in a week, so how would I even do that? And when would I sleep? I love sleeping. Or maybe I take a male colleague's effort and just multiply that by 10. How? How do you multiply effort? If he takes a half hour to pick up lunch for the office, how would I do that 10 times quicker? Can I physically pick up lunch in 3 minutes? If a male colleague is good at answering phones, how can I be 10 times better? Should I be 10 times more cheerful? 10 times more accommodating? If I answered the phone and he never did, how would I even know what to base my effort on? This all sounded like I was being set up for failure. As for my looks, I've always been happy with my appearance, but I know I'm not insanely attractive. My parents and my husband are probably the only people who would say I'm that good looking, but my mom thinks, genuinely believes, that my brother looks like John Hamm. So can we really trust her judgment? She also thinks I have a great singing voice, which is even more damning evidence of her mom bias. Unfortunately, neither my parents nor my husband run an entertainment company. So what good does it do me anyway if they think I'm pretty? It wouldn't help me get ahead in Hollywood, apparently. This is the idea I had of the entertainment industry when I was 19, that I was doomed for failure because this one producer arbitrarily set rules on what a woman would have to do in order to succeed in this business. I recently Googled him to see what he was up to, and he hasn't produced a movie in almost 15 years. Maybe he should try working 10 times harder than the other producers. Or being insanely attractive. My ass. It was a typical day in the office. Conan hadn't gone down to the studio for rehearsal, and he was taking his morning meetings. I was toggling between the Netflix window and my Outlook window, multitasking like a champ. I got up to grab a snack from the kitchen, and that's when it happened. In order to get to the kitchen from where I sat, you would have to walk through the main lobby of the floor. Our office coordinator sat there and would check people in for meetings. Our office coordinator was also in charge of the interns, so there would always be interns milling around waiting to be given instructions for runs. At this point in my time working for Conan, I had already been in a few taped pieces on the show, so viewers of our show were beginning to recognize me. As I was walking to the kitchen, a man in the lobby who looked to be waiting for a meeting with one of our producers saw me and called out to me. Sona? I turned around and saw an older man smiling and waving at me. I couldn't say how old he was, but he gave the vibe that back when he first started working in the entertainment industry, it was totally okay to bang your assistant and do lines of coke off your desk. He was wearing comfortable clothes and had his white hair slicked back. Hi! I said this to him enthusiastically. I never know how to react. Big fan. I'm happy to hear that, thanks. Sonam Ovsesian, that's Armenian, right? Yes, it is. Like Cher. Or like the Kardashians. Yep. I fake smile when I talk to people like this. It hurts my face. You don't like the Kardashians? No, I have nothing against them. I just like Cher more. Is it because you're jealous of Kim? What? No, not at all. Good, because you have a much better ass than she does. I stood there, silent, for a while. I had my fake smile still plastered across my face. I didn't know what else to do but stand there and smile. Finally, after what seemed like forever, haha, that's definitely not true. I have to go to the kitchen now. This was offensive on several levels. First of all, I absolutely do not have a better ass than Kim Kardashian. I've seen her ass in person, and it's majestic. She came on the show once with her sisters, and she was wearing a tight black and white dress. Another time, she came on wearing a tight brown skirt. Both times, her ass was accentuated, and it was perfect. So I feel qualified to comment. My ass is not big, and it's not small. It's just average. It's not toned. There's a lot of cellulite. It lacks any type of definition. Don't get me wrong. It's not a terrible ass. It's just not as good as Kim Kardashian's, let alone better than hers. Second, this dickhead said this in front of the office coordinator and a couple interns who happened to be in the lobby at the time. This was such an embarrassing way to get undermined in front of my coworker. Having an older man remark on my ass. Having anyone remark on your ass is absolutely not okay. But having someone, a stranger even, who looks like they're staring death in the face is even creepier. I think the worst part about it is knowing how vocal this younger generation of interns is and how I just stood there like an asshole and didn't say anything. There was no, "How dare you speak to me like that?" or "Don't ever say anything about my ass." Just a meek response. And I just know everyone looked at my butt when he said what he said, thinking they'd see something that would give Kim Kardashian a run for her money. But no, nothing. Just a poor, pathetic excuse for an ass. So not only did this jerk-off diminish my worth down to just a body part, he belittled me, using a body part I'm not even proud of. If he'd commented on my boobs, that would have been another story. And finally, I was at work, getting a snack like I always do. He ruined snack time for me, and that is unforgivable. As I walked into the kitchen, I felt disgusting. Like someone had stripped me naked in front of everyone at work and grabbed a pointer and directed it to my ass. I was angry the interns saw that interaction, and even angrier that they saw me take his comment quietly. After leaving the kitchen, I walked into our area where Conan and Jeff Ross's offices are, and I was recounting the interaction to Jeff's assistant. Conan heard and came out and asked me what had happened, and so I told him. He was playing his guitar, and I saw the gears turning in his mind. Then he looked at me and said, "What do you need me to do? I don't know who he's having a meeting with, but I'm happy to tell him to leave." I almost cried. It was a tale of two men. One making a woman feel like garbage, and the other using his position to stand up for her. If anything, the interaction made me realize I was working for the right person, even in an industry that has a long way to go. While there is still a contingent of people who are stuck in the past, a new wave of progressive men and women is making it difficult for the old guard to thrive anymore. I looked at Conan and told him he didn't need to worry about it. "That douche is going to die soon anyway," is what I actually said. Then after the meeting the guy had with one of our producers, I walked into that producer's office and told him what that guy had said, hoping the revelation would deter the producer from inviting the man back into the office. Which it did. Was it going to help this old man learn the error of his ways? Not at all, but I felt good about it nonetheless. Don't date coworkers. When I was an intern at a small TV production company, one of the assistants asked me out. I was a sophomore in college at the time, and I knew it was a bad idea for me to go out with him, but I said yes because he was cute and I thought it would be awkward if I rejected him. I thought a good compromise was for him to go out with me and my friends to a concert we were going to at the Roxy that weekend. We met up at the Roxy and went to the concert. Then we all went to grab drinks afterward at a bar nearby on Sunset Boulevard. Then finally, we grabbed some late-night food. There were about five of us in the group, and it became very evident early on that this guy from work was a dud. Sure, he was good-looking, but he didn't have much to talk about, he didn't have a sense of humor, and anytime he did say something, it didn't add much to the conversation. It would just kind of hang there. After we ate, he walked me to my car, and I successfully rebuffed his advances, knowing that going to my internship on Monday was going to be very awkward. And it was. There was an inter-office messaging service we used between employees, and he messaged me as soon as I got to my desk, just saying hi and opening the door for a flirty conversation. He sat a few feet from me so he could literally see my facial expressions when I read his messages. I offered no smile, no look of longing, just stoicism, which is always a bad sign. For the sake of the internship, I realized I had to be honest with him and tell him I wasn't interested. Well, not completely honest. I told him we couldn't keep dating because we worked together. A flimsy excuse when you've already gone on a date. But I dutifully typed out the message and sent it via Office IM. Of course, my ego wanted to believe he'd be devastated, that he'd plead with me to reconsider. But he didn't. He barely even flinched. Then he asked me if one of my friends who had been with us when we went out was single because he wanted her number. You can't fault a guy for trying. But then he didn't ask me to do anything for him or his boss throughout the rest of my time interning at the company. He barely acknowledged my existence. I would message him asking if he needed anything, and he'd just respond with, "No thanks," or, "All good." Right. So that's how I learned it was a mistake to date someone at work. If it didn't work out and I was honest with them, I still could get iced out. My internship was great, but it could have been even better had I been given the opportunity to help everyone in the office without worrying about a fragile assistant getting in the way. I took that realization with me to every job after that. Relationships are messy, and so complicating work relationships with romantic ones can only hinder what you get out of a job. And no, my friend wasn't into it. Poor guy got rejected twice. Dave. In May of 2015, I got a call from David Letterman's assistant, Mary Barkley, giving me a heads up that a gift was being delivered to Conan. That year, Conan had penned a lovely tribute to David Letterman for Dave's final show. As a thank you, Dave got him a gift. She called me to let me know it would be a difficult delivery. She made it clear that it wasn't a typical gift and that it would require special attention and the lot would need to be notified. I was intrigued. I told the head of our security, Jim Stack, that something was being delivered and I wasn't sure what it was. We get things messengered to us all the time and it's never been a big deal. The messengers, or parcels, get screened at an off-lot location, then get brought to the studio. I couldn't imagine what was going to be so difficult. Later, the security booth at the entrance called me, concerned. "Do you know there's a delivery for Conan?" "Yes, thanks. You can just have the driver come to the studio." "It's not going to be that easy." "It's not? Why?" "We'll talk to Jim." A little while later, Jim called my desk. "It's a horse." "What's a horse?" "The delivery that came for Conan." "It's a horse." "A real one?" "Yes." "I don't understand. Someone delivered a horse to the lot for Conan." "What do we do with it?" "We're working on getting it onto the lot right now." "Okay." I walked into Conan's office. I didn't want to tell him what it was and ruin the surprise, so I just said there was a delivery from David Letterman and he had to go outside to get it. Confused, Conan went out of the studio, walked down to the small alley by the side of the building, and there it was. Conan's comedy hero had sent him a horse as a thank you gift. A big, 11-year-old, brown and white horse named Dave. We all stood there, baffled. No one had any clue what to do next, so Conan did the only thing he could do. He got on the horse and took a photo. After a few minutes of looking at the horse and petting it, we all realized we had to figure out what to do with it after the show. In the meantime, Dave, the horse, went back to the ranch from where he came, waiting to see what the horse's new family would do with it next. I won't discuss what this meant to Conan or what later became of the horse because it's not my story to tell. What I love about this is how Mary, Dave's assistant, had to arrange everything. It's what the job of an assistant is. If your boss says, "Send Conan a horse," you have to figure out how to do it. In June of 2009, Michael Jackson died. I was about 6 months into my time working for Conan, so our rapport was still being established. Conan always gives me a call to check in when he's on his way into the office. After we went through the usual business, he said he had a request. "Oh, one last thing. I know Michael Jackson died recently, and I want to be able to say goodbye to him the proper way. Can you call Drew," Shane, our publicist at the time, "and see how I can have a private viewing of his body?" "Yes, of course," I said emphatically. I didn't know what Conan's relationship was with Michael Jackson. What if they were friends? 6 months wasn't long enough for me to know who Conan did and didn't have a relationship with, so how would I have known the request wasn't legitimate? To add insult to injury, I dutifully made a note in my notebook. Call Drew. Private viewing of Michael Jackson's body for Conan. Time alone to say goodbye. As with a lot of requests, especially ones from my early days, I didn't know how I was going to do it. I just knew it had to get done. So my gears started turning trying to figure out who I would get in touch with to arrange for Conan to have some alone time with Michael Jackson's body. I knew these requests were going to happen as soon as I started working for a celebrity. I knew there were going to be moments when I was going to get a request unlike any I'd ever had before. I had watched the movies and I had spoken to enough assistants to know that sometimes our bosses were going to ask for odd things and we were just going to have to get it done somehow. Conan and I ended our conversation and I started brainstorming. Do I get in touch with someone from Michael Jackson's team directly or should I go through Drew? Do you go through publicists to handle a request this personal? If Conan was close to Michael, maybe he was also close to the other Jacksons. Would it be weird for me to find a way to contact Janet? Why wasn't there any contact information for Michael in Conan's address book? Maybe it was under an alias? I didn't want to bother Conan with any questions about this, but I might have to since it was so personal. If I was going to spend time with a friend's body to say goodbye, wouldn't it be more appropriate to go through less professional avenues? While I was thinking about my next step, Conan called me again. He went through a few more show-related things he needed me to get done, then threw this in there at the end. I just thought of something. Call Lee Brekeen, Conan's lawyer, and ask her what I would need to do to adopt Blanket. Michael Jackson's son? Yes, he said, amused by himself. Over the years, I would come to understand what the inflections in his speech mean, when he is doing a bit and when he is serious. He would never be able to get away with this kind of request now. Is this a bit? And that's when he started laughing. He asked, "Did you think I was serious about the private viewing of his body too?" I didn't respond. I let him have his moment. A few minutes later, he walked into the office and started telling everyone the story. Then he looked at my notebook. Call Drew. Private viewing of Michael Jackson's body for Conan. Time alone to say goodbye. There it was. Evidence that I had taken him seriously. He took my notebook and started showing everyone he could find. It was brutal. That was a big learning moment for me. Not only is most of what Conan says a bit, but he also loves when he can take something I do and make everyone laugh at me. I realized that while assistant duties like running errands or keeping his schedule are valuable to him, being fodder for his riffs is an even bigger gift. Perhaps what has kept me employed all these years has been that I'm an endless well of material. And although I may lack in other areas, that's far more valuable for him. Throughout my time working for Conan, I learned that he's not the kind of guy to ask for things that are impossible to figure out. Getting reservations at a popular restaurant or tickets to a sold-out show or a product that is no longer available is actually easy for me to do for him because so many people know who he is and love him. 9 times out of 10, anything that Conan needs to get done will get done without any heavy lifting. Every once in a while, we do encounter people who don't know who he is, and those are some of my favorite moments. They bring him back down to earth. This one time, after we shot a remote at the Santa Anita racetrack, we went to a popular dumpling house called Din Tai Fung in a shopping plaza nearby. Since then, it has expanded to a popular restaurant chain, but the original location in the United States was this one, in a small strip mall in Arcadia, California. I told Conan before we went that there was always a long wait at this restaurant because it's so popular, and he boastfully said he would take care of it. He confidently walked up to the hostess and asked for a table for the three of us. The hostess looked at him blankly and told him it would be a 45-minute wait. Our head writer, Matt O'Brien, and I were so happy we were there for that moment. We stood there for 45 minutes, waiting for a table. And every once in a while, a fan would notice Conan and he would take photos with them outside. So many of them asked him why he was waiting, and he had no response. What was he supposed to say? They didn't recognize me? What joy. When we finally did sit down, a few of the employees either Googled him or just deduced that he was famous by the response others were giving him. And he started taking photos with everybody. By the end of the meal, he was a celebrity again. But oh, what a 45 minutes it was. Anyway, the point is that anything Conan needs to get done can normally get done easily. I'm just glad I didn't call any of Michael Jackson's reps before Conan called me back. I don't know how I would have recovered from that. Murder. Like I mentioned earlier on in the book, I read Helter Skelter while I was working in a watch store in the mall during the early years of college. The story fascinated me, especially as a lifelong Angeleno, though, to be fair, LA is a dream for anyone intrigued by murder. You can drive by a townhouse in Laurel Canyon where four people were beaten to death with pipes, dubbed the Wonderland Murders. There's a Los Feliz murder house where a man killed his wife, then attacked his daughter with a hammer before he killed himself by drinking poison. The house where Marvin Gaye's father shot him is still standing, and so is the condo where Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered. Conan and I found out early on that we shared a common interest in murder when he told me he was reading Helter Skelter. I told him I had read it years prior, and then we excitedly started talking about these gruesome murders. I think I was only a few months into working for him, and I was excited we had found common ground already, even if it was the shared fascination with the brutality of murder. One day, Conan had a shoot after the show, and we had to stay late. He had sent his car back earlier that day, so I was tasked with driving him home. As we were driving, Conan realized we were near Benedict Canyon, the area where members of Charles Manson's cult murdered five people, including a very pregnant Sharon Tate. We decided it would be a good idea to drive by the house on Cielo Drive, just to take a look. You know, like bonding. We Googled the original address of the house and noticed that it had been torn down and the address had been changed to avoid looky-loos and weirdos who were fascinated by murder, like Conan and me. The house is situated on a small side street off Benedict Canyon, one without too much traffic. It's easy for a car to be noticed there, so when we were driving to the house, we turned my headlights off. Conan put on a baseball hat so he wouldn't be noticed, and we slowed down to a creeping speed. So there we were, two individuals in a car at a location where LA's most famous murders happened at a very late hour in the night, driving very slowly with our headlights off. The passenger, wearing a hat so as not to be noticed. I'm sure the house has had many random people come to look at it, but how suspicious we looked wasn't lost on me. And that's when it hit me. What if someone called the police and the police came to see Conan O'Brien sitting in front of a famous murder house? What would that TMZ headline be? Welcome to LA! Conan O'Brien and a random woman stalk site of Manson murders in the middle of the night. Okay, so I know this isn't something I should harp on, but after working for Conan for a while, I realized I was always going to be some random woman who was with him. If the plane that we were flying in crashed, the headline would be, Late night host and comedy icon Conan O'Brien dies in plane crash. A nation mourns. A random woman also dead. If together we somehow discovered the cure for cancer, the headline would be, Conan O'Brien changes the world by finding cure for all cancer, saving millions of lives. Oh yeah, a random woman helped him. If we saved children from a burning bus and I saved 30 kids and he saved none, Conan O'Brien saves the day. Funny late-night quipster can add hero to his resume as he saves an entire bus of children from a fiery demise. Some piece of shit random woman was also there. Most moments, I didn't care that I was a random woman. And on this night, sitting in my car on a quiet street near Beverly Hills, watching my boss go outside to take a look at the driveway that led up to the house where three cold-blooded murderers took the lives of five innocent people and an unborn child, I thought it would be okay with me that no one would recognize me if we got caught. I was a few months into my new job, and I was still getting a feel for who Conan was and what my responsibilities were. I never would have guessed they would include visiting sites where famous deaths occurred. If only that were the end of it. When we were in Washington, D.C. on a work trip, we were driving by Ford's Theater on the way back to the hotel, and Conan made the car stop to show us where Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. He explained where he was shot, where his body was taken after for treatment, and told us the exact time when Lincoln was pronounced dead. The details Conan knows about this assassination would put a Ford's Theater docent to shame. When we were in Dallas for a week of shows, we visited Dealey Plaza, where JFK was assassinated, as well as the Sixth Floor Museum, located at the spot where Lee Harvey Oswald fired the fateful shots that ended the life of a beloved president. Naturally, we took a tour. Conan often jumped in with a new bit of information that even this tour guide, whose job it is to know everything about the assassination, didn't know. When we were in Mexico City shooting a Conan Without Borders travel special, Conan visited the Leon Trotsky Museum, a museum housing the room where a man struck Leon Trotsky in the back of the skull with an alpine climbing axe, effectively killing him. Trotsky would succumb to his injuries a day later, despite initially surviving the blow. Conan bought a keychain there, with Trotsky's face on it, and still has it hooked to his denim jacket. Strangely, this is one of my favorite things about Conan. He's so well-versed in history. It's what he studied when he was a student at Harvard, and he's maintained a fascination with it since. He's not someone who can be defined only by his career in television. I think so many celebrities allow what they do to become who they are. I've seen so many people who revel so much in being famous that they don't feel a need to expand on that, to stretch themselves beyond their persona and have interests outside of the entertainment world. Conan is equally as excited to go explore a Civil War battlefield as he would be to interview John Lithgow. Well, that might be a stretch. Conan loves John Lithgow. Anyway, Conan is constantly reading about something and educating himself. That's not me. It's one of the main ways we're different. History is cool and all, but if it doesn't have any steamy sex scenes, then what's the point? On that note, I'm sorry this book doesn't have any steamy sex scenes. Anyway, the house where the Manson murders occurred was torn down in 1994 and the address has been changed. So to retrace the steps of Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, and Patricia Krenwinkel by climbing an embankment near the gate is no longer possible. But when Conan got back to my car after scouting the location, he said he thought the driveway where Stephen Parent tried to leave the property before being shot by Watson was still there. He and I sat in the car and craned our necks and took in the street, morbidly fascinated by what had occurred there 40 years earlier. It was odd, but it was also a big bonding moment for us. In the years to come, I would buy Conan books on famous murders as birthday or Christmas gifts and send him interesting articles on new, gruesome murders that occurred in present day. It's our cute little thing. In 2017, my husband, a few friends, and I embarked on an Alaskan cruise. While having dinner on the ship one night, we were interrupted by a message on the intercom overhead asking all security and medical personnel to head to the 9th floor of the ship immediately. We were slightly concerned, but not concerned enough to stop eating the ungodly amount of food in front of us. Plus, the murder mystery show on the ship's social calendar was at the very same time, so one of the theories we had for the mysterious intercom message was that it was somehow tied to the show. It was not. The following morning, we were supposed to be sightseeing the beautiful Alaskan fjords, but instead, we awoke to find ourselves at port in Juneau. The captain came on the intercom to give us an awful morning message about the change in plans. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain. I'm sorry to inform you that last night there was a domestic disturbance aboard the ship and a woman from Utah has died. Because we were out at sea, this is a matter for the FBI. We will be at port while they conduct their investigation." Murder. On a cruise ship. Shortly after, the social director of the cruise came on the intercom. "Hi, everyone. This is your social director. All activities on our social calendar will continue as planned." As I made my way to the ship's daily afternoon tea, my favorite activity, I thought about the one guy who would be intrigued by what had happened. Conan. I sat at the table enjoying my usual fare of scones, small sandwiches, and pastries, and I drafted an email to Conan describing the cruise ship murder. I felt like Agatha Christie. Details eventually emerged about the murder, and my friends and I stayed current with updates as they occurred. A man and woman from Utah had been on the Alaskan cruise with members of their family, including their three daughters. After a night out, they came back to their room where the woman told the man she wanted a divorce. He snapped and beat her to death. Years later, he would plead guilty and receive 30 years in prison. in an unsatisfying ending, rather than serving out his punishment, the man was found dead in his prison cell shortly after his appeal was rejected. No cause of death was released. I would send any article with an update to Conan, who was both fascinated and horrified by the incident. I wanted to talk it out with someone, to try to find some reasoning behind such an unforgivable act. It was nice to have someone in my life I could posit theories with, talking it out in a way that would make sense of it, or at least make it just a story instead of an actual occurrence. Conan often jokes about how he thinks he'll be murdered one day. How poetic would it be if I murdered him and some 40 years later, a boss and his assistant took a drive to where the murder took place? I feel like this is the only way our story can end. This is my confession. Why Conan can't fire me. You might be asking yourself why someone who has an assistant who writes a book called The World's Worst Assistant, a book in which said assistant fantasizes about one day murdering that someone, would continue to employ said assistant. Easy. You have to make yourself necessary. And not necessary in a way that makes you important to day-to-day tasks in the office. I mean necessary in a way that would instill fear in your boss if he ever decided to fire you. Conan gave me a small opening into his world, and I took that info and made myself indispensable. Here are the reasons why Conan would never be able to fire me. You are welcome to take these tactics and apply them to your workplace. Number one, if you have access to their financial and/or personal information, quietly bank it in your memory. I've memorized Conan's social security number, his driver's license number, and all his important credit card numbers. Of course, I would never destroy his credit or steal from him if I were ever fired, but the possibility that I could is enough to instill fear. Number two, over the years, I have revealed my true self mostly to Conan. I have gotten very close to his family and friends. When Conan asks me to do something, it can fall through the cracks, and the cracks are massive. San Andreas fault-size cracks. When his family or his friends ask me for a favor, I take care of it quickly and efficiently. My plan is to make everyone who matters to Conan think I'm actually good at my job. The intention here is that if he were ever to fire me, everyone in his life would think he was crazy. "She's so on top of it," they would say. "Why would you ever let someone that hardworking go?" they would ask. I might be fired, but he would be considered crazy. Many of his friends work in the entertainment industry, so a simple email to a few of them acting innocent would be enough to make him look unreasonable and help land me another job. Number three, Conan is a bit of a Luddite. Over the years, anytime he has needed to download an app or open an account somewhere, I've done it for him. Because of my position, I've had to have access to his email and other accounts. I know all of Conan's passwords. Here's what I would do with the information I have. Email. I would put on an out-of-office that was littered with inappropriate language, then change his password so he couldn't fix it right away. Then I would reach out to all his contacts and say something horrible to them that would jeopardize his relationships. iTunes. I would download all kinds of porn onto his devices, then change his password. Tesla. I would control his car remotely, then change his password. Again, I'm not a monster. I would never actually do any of this. But again, the possibility that I could dangles in the air. And in case he never thought of it before, this section in this book is a reminder that I could. Number four, you may be wondering if he could just recover his passwords using his email. Many of his online accounts and apps have my email for password recovery. Even his cell phone is under my name. As far as the online world is concerned, Conan doesn't even exist. Number five, Conan has made fun of me in emails. I've been compiling these for our inevitable court case in the future. Here are some samples. These are all 100% real. This first email is from Conan to his good friend Lynette. We were going to New York to do a week of shows, and she had emailed him asking to come to one of the tapings. This was his response and a good example of his positive reinforcement. From Conan O'Brien. Sent Tuesday, October 18th, 2016, to Lynette C. CC Sonam Obsession. Subject, COB in NYC. I will be there the first week of November. Our first show is Halloween. Not sure what my schedule will be like, but definitely come see a show and I'm sure we will get together. Sona will handle it all. She's almost like an assistant. Ha 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 ha. Devil emoji. The following email is a good example of the nonsense Conan emails me from time to time. I've often joked that 90% of the things he tells me are complete and utter nonsense. This is just the tip of the iceberg. From Conan O'Brien, sent Thursday, August 16th, 2018, to Sonam Obsession. Subject, schedule. Just landed. Could you get to my house and make me a corn cob burrito? On August 16th, 2018, Sonam Obsession wrote, I can call Kim and ask her to leave a LaCroix on the counter with some almonds. On August 16, 2018, C. O'Brien wrote, I'm not kidding. Drive over and bring an onion mojito, an eye patch made of dried apricot, and a portrait of Margaret Thatcher. Here's another example of the positive reinforcement that keeps me going at this job. In Conan's defense, I did respond like an asshole. From Conan O'Brien, sent Wednesday, December 31st, 2014, to Sonam Obsession. Subject, question. I'm in the New York Times crossword puzzle twice today. On December 31st, 2014, Sonam Obsession wrote, I'm surprised you didn't ask why they didn't have you in there three times. On December 31st, 2014, C. O'Brien wrote, What's a four-letter word that starts with D and ends in CK that means Conan's assistant? In the following email exchange, he had asked me to get him something and it was taking longer than expected to get there. There's an edge here from both of us. This is common. From Conan O'Brien, sent Wednesday, February 6, 2015, to Sonam Obsession. Subject, the mat. Every time I see John, he asks if the mat you ordered has arrived yet. Every time I said, as far as I know, it has not. Today he said he sent you an email and that he never heard back. I told him you smoke a lot of pot and he laughed. It was fun. Where's that mat? On February 6, 2015, Sonam Obsession wrote, Please tell everyone I get stoned. It's nice when strangers know these things about me. On February 6, 2015, C. O'Brien wrote, He laughed because he thought I was joking. People don't take me seriously when I say that my assistant gets stoned and watches The Bachelor at work. So you're safe. This next email was a response to not one, not two, but three different emails I sent out to all of Conan's contacts informing them about his new phone number. On the first email I sent, I accidentally put his old phone number. On the second email, I put the wrong area code, and I finally got it right on the third email. This was Conan's response to one of the replies to the flurry of emails I sent. From Conan O'Brien, sent Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015, to L. Mendoza. Subject, RE, phone number. You don't understand, Larry. I taught her English 2 years ago. She still thinks the office phone is the devil's watchdog. When it rains, she eats garlic and gyrates in the parking lot. This is another one of our dumb email exchanges. From Conan O'Brien, sent Wednesday, April 1st, 2015, to Sonam Obsession. Subject, today. Because there are two tapings, do you see any reason I can't stroll in a bit later? Maybe email me the seg notes if you have them. On April 1st, 2015, Sonam Obsession wrote, Sure, you can come in when you want. I'll have producers email me the notes and I'll send them to you. On April 1st, 2015, C. O'Brien wrote, Excellent, I will be in at 5. On April 1st, 2015, Sonam Obsession wrote, Wait, you have to be here before that. On April 1st, 2015, C. O'Brien wrote, Fart. There's nothing really wrong with the next email exchange. It just further highlights how different Conan and I are. We filmed a remote years after this exchange where Conan joins my friends and me for a midnight showing of Magic Mike XXL. From Sonam Obsession, sent Friday, September 13th, 2012, to Conan O'Brien. Subject, Lincoln. The trailer for the movie about Lincoln starring Daniel Day-Lewis. And here I put the YouTube link. On September 13th, 2012, C. O'Brien wrote, Thanks, I can't wait to see that. It's my Magic Mike. Here's an exchange where, once again, Conan kindly reveals what a valuable employee I am. From Sonam Obsession, sent Thursday, October 16th, 2014, to Conan O'Brien. Subject: check out these bikes. They are awesome, but will kill you if you ride them in LA traffic. On October 16, 2014, C. O'Brien wrote, "Yep, that may be how I die." On October 16, 2014, Sonam Obsession wrote, "Please don't do that. I'm unemployable." On October 16, 2014, C. O'Brien wrote, "At last we agree on something." Yes, many of these show a lapse in professionalism by both of us, but because he's my boss, the onus is on him, right? Who sets the tone for professionalism in the workplace if not the boss? Anyway, of course, I would never ruin his credit or steal from him or sue him for abuse using these emails as evidence, but the implication that I can is always dangling in the air. The chance that I could snap and remotely control his car without him knowing it is not only funny, but frightening. I'm sure he'll one day find a way to remove me from his life, but until then, I'll be sitting at my desk enjoying a movie. Part 4. Sona sits at her desk playing with a pooping reindeer toy her friend Bill in props gave her as a present. You put brown jelly beans into it and move its tail, and it then poops out the brown jelly beans. Sona has been beaten. She has no idea how she's going to tell Conan she wasted most of the day either eating or calling her friend with impressions of British royalty and just completely forgot what he asked her to do. An intern brings in the mail, and Sona starts a conversation. Sona: do you know anyone in publishing? An intern: what? Sona: publishing. Is your mom or dad friends with someone who works in publishing? An intern: my uncle reads a lot. Does that help? Sona: no, but it's good he reads. An intern: yeah. Do you need anything else? Sona: no, thank you. The confused intern scurries off. Sona starts looking through the mail. Maybe fan mail will distract Conan? That's it. She'll stroke his ego so he's too preoccupied to notice she didn't get what he needed. The first letter is from a man in Rhode Island. Dear Conan, I saw one of your sketches on YouTube about gravy boat lighthouses. I just think you should know that I work on an actual lighthouse, and it's nothing to make jokes about. Just because gravy is served in a gravy boat doesn't mean they need a lighthouse. It's people like you who ruin the image of hardworking people like me who devote our lives to making sure boats know where they're going. Fuck you. Okay. Not off to a good start. The second letter is from a woman in Nebraska. Ah, the heartland. Hello, Conan. I'm a junior high English teacher in Norfolk, Nebraska. I was watching your monologue on Tuesday and noticed you erroneously used the term who when you should have used the term whom. Here is a refresher from the website Grammarly for your reference. Whom should be used to refer to the object of a verb or preposition. When in doubt, try this simple trick. If you can replace the word with he or she, use who. If you can replace it with him or her, use whom. Who should be used to refer to the subject of a sentence? Whom should be used to refer to the object of a verb or preposition? I should hope someone who graduated from Harvard would know the difference. But I understand you aren't the only one who writes your monologue jokes. Have a lovely day. A middle school English teacher. Is that how to use whom and who? Sona feels like such a dick for all the times she's used the word whom to sound pretentious. Focus! There are a few more letters, but none flowery enough to distract from the mess Sona has made of today. Conan is expecting the book, and he's going to feel so vindicated when Sona meekly walks into his office to tell him that not only is there no book coming, but also she spent the majority of the day fucking around and completely forgot what it was he wanted in the first place. As Sona is clearing the fan mail from her desk, she sees a package. She looks at the label and it says Caro with a return address in New York. Her stomach drops. She rips the package open and there it is, the advance copy of Robert Caro's book from Robert Caro himself. The note attached reads, "Conan, since you're such a big fan, I thought you'd like an advance copy of my book. Take care, Robert." Sona sits there feeling victorious? No, not that. Lucky? No, not that either. Vindicated. What? Why vindicated? That's absolutely not it. She just feels happy. She takes the note and the book and leaves them on Conan's desk. A short time later, he comes up from taping the show and walks straight into his office. Sona sits there and braces herself, then hears him loudly say, "What?" Conan comes out of his office and asks Sona how she did it. How did she contact Robert Caro directly, and how did he send a copy of the unpublished book that day with a note? This is one of those moments when Sona can either revel in this unwarranted praise or come clean. "Sona, I told you I'm good at what I do and people like me." She says this with no shame at all. "Conan, I owe you an apology. I really did believe for a second that you forgot what I asked you to do, and I'm so impressed you got this done." "Sona, of course, it's my job." She says this with zero remorse, like a sociopath. Conan walks away and Sona sits there, an asshole with no conscience. Only that's not what happened. In the many years Sona has worked for Conan, she has found it very difficult to lie to him. So this is what really happened. Conan comes out of his office and asks Sona how she did it. This is one of those moments Sona can either revel in unwarranted praise or come clean. "Sona, I didn't. He had already sent you a copy of the book, and it got delivered today. I lied earlier when I said it was on the way. I forgot what you asked me to do, and I didn't want to ask you again because I felt like you'd do a bit on how I always forget to do things when you ask me. So I thought I'd just remember eventually. Only when I finally did remember, it was too late, and I sat at my desk defeated. And that's when the mail came in and Robert Caro sent you the book, and I did nothing except take it out of the package and put it on your desk, and I sat here hoping you wouldn't ask me about it." Conan stands there and nods. He loves this. What an asshole. "Conan, so what did you do all day?" "Sona, I watched some TV, then visited Erica, and then called her and did my Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip impressions, and then I went to the kitchen a lot and ate snacks." Conan, "It sounds like you had a productive day." Sona, "Don't do that." Conan, "No, really, it sounds like you really got a lot done." Sona, "Okay, cool. So you're just going to be passive-aggressive. Cool, cool." Conan, "No, not at all. It takes a lot of work to do the things you did. And I'm so lucky I have such a productive assistant." Sona, "Maybe if you created an environment where I could ask you what you needed without worrying if you were going to do bits." Conan, "You're right. I shouldn't expect you to write things down like every other assistant in the world." They go on like this, bickering. Some people walk in to talk to Conan, roll their eyes, and walk straight out as soon as they hear what's going on. This happens often. Stress. I'm not the type of person to stress out. I never have been. In sixth grade, my teacher, Mrs. Hackett, said, "There's a solution to every problem." And for some reason, that stuck with me so intensely that if there's ever an issue that comes up that can be a source of stress, I brush it off. A solution is out there. Maybe someone will find it. But there are times when I might brush it off a bit too much. While I may never stress, it's in Conan's DNA to sweat the smaller stuff. I shrug things off, and he wants to make sure things get done properly. I figure life is too short to care about the mundane details, so I stress over them. He revels in the minutiae. The only problem is my entire job depends on me paying attention to the mundane details. When Conan goes to an event, if I don't pay attention to the small details, then he'll just be walking around confused with no idea what to wear or where to go or when to be there. There will be no car to pick him up and his luggage will be in a different city. I try to make sure I never leave him in that position. One of the biggest arguments Conan and I ever had was over an accessory for his new car. He had purchased a car and was told this one accessory would be available later in the year. Months later, he ran into a friend of his who also purchased that same car and already had the accessory. Conan asked me about it, wondering why we had never been notified and why I never followed up. Excuses were made, and it snowballed into a big argument. Of course, he wasn't angry about not having the accessory. He was angry I didn't care that it was available, and that I wasn't on top of it. To add fuel to the fire, I dismissed it, telling him, rather flippantly, that it was just an accessory and that he shouldn't make a big deal about it. I should have just apologized, but here we were, fighting about something small that was indicative of a bigger issue. That's the problem with my lack of stress. It's inevitable that something will fall through the cracks, and this is where Conan and I butt heads. In the past, I've shrugged it off or given a half-assed sorry. I know he wants me to care more. I can tell it would make everything between us so much easier, but I just can't. There were times when I was younger when I would lose sleep over letting something fall through the cracks or failing to complete a task properly, but then I grew up. I realized adults make mistakes, and as long as we acknowledge them and move on, then I don't know where the harm lies. So now I don't stress. I breathe, I set boundaries, and I just live my life. You might be thinking, Sona, it's a really good thing you're not a surgeon or a pilot. And you were right. People would die. A typical day. You might be wondering what a typical day for me is like. I'm happy to give you an accurate rundown of a regular day for a personal assistant to a celebrity. Oh, the glamour. 10 a.m. Arrive. 10:05 a.m. Go to the kitchen and make a nice cup of loose leaf brewed tea and either a bowl of oatmeal or a bagel and cream cheese. Catch up with whoever is also in the kitchen. 10:30 a.m. Go back to your desk and take time to really enjoy the tea and oatmeal or bagel. 10:45 a.m. Email a few friends with the subject line, "What's for lunch?" 10:45 to 11:15 a.m. Debate about where you're going to get lunch. 11:15 a.m. Order lunch. 11:20 a.m. Figure out who's going to pick up lunch. 11:25 a.m. Give the intern explicit instructions about what condiments to get with said lunch. Lunch won't be ready for another 15 minutes. 11:30 a.m. Put in priority parking for said intern so you don't have to wait for lunch once it gets here. At some point, Conan has arrived at the office, though it's unclear when or how long ago. Maybe he was always here. 11:35 a.m. Check in with Conan. He asks what's happened so far, and you say, it's been a pretty chill morning. 12 p.m. Print out the crossword puzzle and Sudoku puzzles for the day. You print out the easy, medium, and hard versions of the Sudoku puzzle, and if you finish them all, you tell people you completed the trifecta. 12:15 p.m. A PA brings the monologue jokes to your desk. You let them linger because you're timing yourself doing the easy Sudoku puzzle, and you can't let anything throw you off. 12:18 p.m. Finish the easy Sudoku. Any self-respecting Sudoku player takes less than 3 minutes to complete the easy version. You start on the medium and hard versions, and if you finish them all, you call it the trifecta. 12:30 p.m. Lunch arrives. 12:45 p.m. While eating, look over and see the monologue jokes still sitting on your desk. Take them into Conan's office and hand them to him right away. It's late, he says. Blame the writers. 1 p.m. Conan gets called down to rehearsal. 1:05 p.m. It's time to socialize. You visit cubicles and catch up with friends, talk about what everyone had for lunch, compare notes. 2 p.m. Get back to your desk and answer some emails, finally. 2:30 p.m. Get bored and go to the kitchen for a snack. Stand in front of the snacks for a while trying to figure out what to eat. 2:50 p.m. Take a much-deserved walk outside to unwind. 3:15 p.m. Run into your friend who works on a show in a nearby soundstage. Go for a fun ride in the golf cart and catch up. 3:30 p.m. Go to Conan's dressing room for a pre-show meeting with Andy, Jeff Ross, and the writers. 4:30 p.m. Showtime. Watch from the green room or from your desk while doing the crossword puzzle. 5 p.m. Show ends. 5:30 p.m. After the post-show meeting, Conan comes back upstairs and asks if there are any messages. You say no, but you see the red light blinking on your phone. You hope he doesn't see it. You realize you didn't get any actual work done all day. You do your best to convince him it was just a normal day with nothing exciting going on and hope you're right. He goes into his office. You check your emails to make sure there weren't any big issues or emergencies or important messages. Most of the time, there aren't. You did it. You managed to get nothing of any substance done, and you got away with it because you clearly have no morals. You have managed to make everyone around you lower their standards to such a point that they can send you an email and not get a response for several hours, and no one makes a peep about it. You also ate way too much food, and you tell yourself, starting tomorrow, you'll stop snacking so much and maybe even start bringing in your own food. Realize you won't do that and hate yourself for your lack of willpower. 6 p.m. Go home. Danny and Jennifer Aniston. No one has prepared me for my job better than my brother, Danny. I had a 26-year training period to ready myself for the teasing, getting made fun of, and everything